Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable on this Friday morning. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue for a while anyway. Joe will be here at some point, so don't get nervous. Not white knuckle time. Joe will be here. Joining us for the roundtable panel discussion, WAMC's Alan Shartok, University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary Armeo. A little later in the show, Jimmy Vielkind, chief of Capital New York's Albany Bureau, will be here. Feel free to email us, roundtable@wamc.org, if you want to comment on anything you heard or didn't hear, roundtable@wamc.org, and we will try to get good ones in. You can comment on our webpage or Facebook page, or you could tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Good morning, Rosemary. Good morning, Alan. How you guys doing?
Good morning. Good.
So far, so good. You never know.
Well, we'll soon put a stop to that.
Indeed you will, my old friend.
All right. Well, let's get started here on the panel. And the news, which has been dominating things for some time now, Ukraine, Crimea. The pro-Russian regional parliament in Crimea voted behind closed doors yesterday to secede from Ukraine and become part of Russia. This is quoting from the New York Times, an aspirational gesture that had no immediate practical effect but deepened the political crisis there. And speaking at the White House, President Obama denounced the parliament's move as illegal, both under the Ukrainian constitution and international law. We start with you, Rosemary.
It's a ploy by the president, an interesting ploy to call this unconstitutional and to take a heavy stand against it, a coup overthrowing a democratically a democratically elected president seems to be more unconstitutional to me than a parliament decision to hold a referendum. It overlooks the history of the Crimea, which is. It's Russian. It's something like 60% of the population is Russian. They speak Russian. They've been demonstrating in favor of Russia. The Ukrainian government has, the interim government has not handled the situation well. Why is it illegal?
Well, you know, it's an interesting position for the West, for Europe and for the U.S., because, you know, it's traditionally we say, well, let's let democratic self-determination prevail.
Right.
But you have Catalonia, you have Britain with Scotland,
right.
You even have Quebec years
right.
ago.
That's
so,
right.
Alan, is it a double standard we're talking about here?
Well, it's always power politics, and it's always you raise whatever arguments you can on your side. I think, frankly, and I don't know if Rosemary agrees with me, there's always a first time. But I truly think that the die is cast. They're not going to get out of this. I mean, I think, you know, Khrushchev gave it. They're taking it back. They're 60% Russian speakers. Putin cannot afford to lose face in this. If he does, he's a goner, much like Khrushchev was over Cuba. I think everybody's going to have to learn to live with this the way that it is right now, for many of the reasons that Rosemary has pointed out, that you've just pointed out, but also because it's just plain old power politics, and Putin can't afford to back down on that part. I think what we're lucky about is that we're not going the other way, that he's not marching over that border and going to take more.
At this point.
The other thing the United States did, of course, was to freeze the visas. I guess that's the way you say it. He did some dozen Russians and Ukrainians involved in this confrontation and in the engineering of what's going on there have been their visas are no good. They will find it much harder to travel in the West. So again, it's a coercive move. Before the show, Ray and I were talking about this intriguing. It's very short, one page article in the Washington Post today. They went to Henry Kissinger, the old Secretary of State from 73 to 77. He had a kind of a little war he dealt with in Vietnam and got his opinion on this. And it's fascinating. Have you seen that, Alan?
Was in the Washington
Post. I'd love to hear about it.
I'd
love to hear about it.
He takes this long view. I don't remember him being this great about strategizing in Vietnam, but he says basically the U.S. has to think of its end game. What do we really want here?
Russia needs to as well.
And Russia does as well. Something we did not do, though, in Iraq or Afghanistan or in Vietnam, and look what happened. So he has this four-point plan for what he would do, and it's if I can go over those, I will. One is Ukraine. should have the right to choose freely its economic and political associations. So in other words, right now we're in a tug of war. It's either the EU or the Russians.
Right.
Why? Why aren't they like Yugoslavia after World War One and negotiating between the East and the West? He sees Ukraine as a bridge between them.
Let me stop you for a minute. Sure. Let me stop you for a minute, Rosemary, because the question, it seems to me, is coming, it will always come down to, is who is Ukraine? Is Ukraine, yeah, you know, everything minus, you know, the excess territory, or is it in fact, you know, the whole thing? If you vote as the whole thing,
yeah,
you get one result.
That's a good question. And if you read the article, Kissinger makes it clear he's talking about the whole country. He thinks Russia
exactly
definitely has right to protect its fleet, which is based there, much the way we protect property in Cuba. We're certainly not friends with Cuba,
sure,
but we have the right to Guantanamo. Mm. So he sees that the same way. His second point is that Ukraine should not join NATO. That's a position Kissinger has always had, and it just makes so much sense to me. If we had Russia joining with, say, Canada and Mexico in a defense pact, what would be our response? It's just an act of provocation. It's clearly provocation. Three, he says Ukraine should be free to create any government compatible with that expressed by the will of its people. This calls for good Ukrainian leadership, which it has not had. As we were talking about earlier,
as he points out, independent for 23 years.
Yeah,
and they haven't figured it out.
Very young, they're very bad. They did have their Orange Revolution back in the early 2000s, and they messed it up. It was a horrible government filled with corruption, and the people eventually, you know, soured of that, returned the old communist leader in, and now we're in the situation we are now.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be some sort of aid and support to let's have a good government here. That would help a lot. And fourth, is specifically Crimea, which you asked about earlier. Crimea's relationship to Ukraine has to be less tense than it is right now. Russia would recognize Ukraine's sovereignty over Crimea, but also Ukraine would reinforce its autonomy in elections and make sure that there was no ambiguity about the status of the Black Sea Fleet, which is the Russian Navy in Sevastopol.
Kissinger makes some really interesting points. And one is, and I'll quote, "The West must understand that to Russia, Ukraine can never be just a foreign country."
Right.
Russian history began in what was called Kievan Rus. The Russian religion spread from there. And then a brilliant point, several paragraphs down, "Russia and the West, and least of all the various factions in Ukraine, have made the situation worse. Russia would not be able to impose a military solution without isolating itself at a time when many of its borders are already precarious. And for the West, the demonization of Vladimir Putin is not a policy. It is an alibi for the absence
Absolutely.
Of one." That is as brilliant as it gets.
Yeah, I love that part. It's just easy to say he's evil, we must act, the Hitler argument.
Yeah.
And it's just not true. He's basically doing what I believe the U.S. would do in a similar situation. And we need to put ourselves in his head and think what he would do.
Alan, let's let you get the last word on this segment, and then we'll take a break and move on.
My last word is this. Easier said than done, Mr. Kissinger. You know, in other words, these are the things he would do, but I don't think that's in the cards right now. In other words, I don't see how it resolves other than that the best thing for the United States right now would be, say, Crimea stays where it is, even if we slap a couple of guys on the hand, and that they don't come over the border and grab the rest of it. To me, that's the most hopeful outcome.
Alan, let the record show that Rosemary just said she thinks you're right, so I think that's a splendid.
I better reconsider my position.
Let me pick my jaw off the floor, and we'll take a break. You can join the conversation by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org. roundtable@wamc.org. Back in a flash.
Support for WAMC comes from Affordable Self Storage in Rhinebeck, Kingston, and Hudson. In support and appreciation of Hudson Valley Hospice, serving Dutchess and Ulster counties, working to enhance the quality of living for those near the end of life, hvhospice.org. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, henyonbakery.com. And the Blue Marble, a world of gifts, Amherst, Massachusetts, featuring goods from across the country and around the globe with a concentration on handcrafted, American-made, and fair trade items, thebluemarble.biz.
Welcome back to the roundtable. 23 minutes after 9 o'clock, Ray Graff in temporarily for Joe Donahue. Rosemary Armeo is here. Alan Shartok, a little later in the hour, Jimmy Vielkind of Capital New York will be with us. And Alan, we have an email.
We do. Michael writes, Hitler demanded the Sudetenland for the same reason, ethnic German speakers living there. Chamberlain gave it to him and see what happened. Well, Rosemary, I think you might have you might have some historical differences with this fellow.
No, in fact, I brought up the Sudetenland in an early show about it. That seems to be the ploy, and I think there's something to that. But so
Hillary
far,
Hillary agrees with you, by the way.
I know. So far, he has not seized it, though. He's going a different route, and Kissinger is advocating, and I have also, so is Angela Merkel, a diplomatic solution.
Yep.
So,
and once again, you can email us. roundtable@wamc.org, and we will read them.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay, I just wanted to check in for one thing and say this. I think there's a difference between Hitler and the Russian premier. I just think it's not the same.
All right, fair enough.
So we'll see.
I appreciate the email, and thanks very much for checking in. All right, let's switch gears here before the news and go with one we saw break yesterday afternoon. This quoting from the New York Times, Senate rejects blocking military commanders from sexual assault cases. The Senate on Thursday rejected a controversial bipartisan bill to remove military commanders from decisions over the prosecution of sexual assault cases in the armed forces, delivering a defeat to advocacy groups that argued that wholesale changes are necessary to combat an epidemic of rapes and sexual assaults in the military. Interestingly, in this case, the block was led by a fellow Democrat of Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, Senator Claire McCaskill of Missouri, and the politics are interesting in this case.
Real interesting and troubling. She's not just a fellow Democrat. She's a, does that work, fellow woman.
Okay, it works.
These are issues about which I would like to see women united. But McCloskey clearly had the point of view of the military, and Gillibrand, I think, was the right position. I'd vote with her. Wanted to take decisions about whether to prosecute cases out of the hand of the military. So I had to really struggle to figure out what McCloskey's point was, other than just supporting, you know, military control of these matters.
And Alan, interesting in this case that several Republicans, including Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky and Charles Grassley of Ohio, supported the Gillibrand proposal.
I was just going to add, Alan, that had it been allowed to go to a vote, which was the action that was, it wasn't, it would have passed. Gillibrand did have the support for it.
Alan?
Yeah, I was going to say the same exact thing. They had 55 votes, which was going to be enough to pass the bill. It's one of the reasons that the Senate doesn't always work, and they needed to stop a filibuster. I think that the reason McCaskill goes the other way is she puts her finger up in the wind and sees the way the wind is blowing, which is in Missouri, they don't like the plan. I think Gillibrand was right also. I think you need an outside look into this thing. The way they resolved. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I thought about that and said, well, how can that be? You know, what is she reading if she thinks that when the Senate would have gone along with it? But there actually are some arguments for her point of view. And don't forget, she was a military prosecutor and then a civilian prosecutor. So she's not stupid. She's not just being anti-feminist.
This is Senator McCloskey.
Yeah. So, I don't think anybody would say she was stupid. Yeah,
but here's some of the reasons. If she is saying that had this law in effect during the past wars we've had, you would not have seen prosecutions for sexual assault in Iraq or in Afghanistan because you would have had to fly military prosecutors in from the United States. That takes time and effort. It would not have happened. She's saying this system actually could facilitate prosecutions. They also argue that more rape prosecutions have been stopped by prosecutors rather than by commanders.
Mm.
So,
well, they're coming up with another plan, which is that if the prosecutor disagrees with the general, then you know then they have to duke it out which I think is an interesting compromise.
That's the compromise that was approved, that there would be a civilian review of it. The problem with that, of course, is that it's hard enough for civilians, much less women in the military, to say, "Hey, I was raped, this is what happened to me. Now you're going to be doing it not only to your military commander and a prosecutor, but then going to a civilian board and arguing that, hey, I really was abused. How many women are going to do that? This is so discouraging. The good thing about all of this, though, is that the issue is now in the air, and you can bet that Gillibrand and the people who support her are going to be monitoring and watching this. So the fight will go on, as she said.
I think you're absolutely correct, and I think Rand Paul said basically the same thing. He said the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And then Grassley said the Defense Department has been promising the American people for a long time that they're working on the problem of sexual assault. And he said enough is enough. So there would seem to be bipartisan move to do something.
Yeah, the UN, I've forgotten her name, maybe one of you can recall it. She's the official in charge of war crimes and gender issues. And she made a statement yesterday, which was interesting considering what was going on in our Senate, that worldwide there's more attention being paid and more movement being paid to war crimes against women, you know, rape and kidnapping of women, for example, as a punishment. And I really do believe that there is something of a new global women's movement to protect women against these sorts of outrages. And so the debate in the Senate, to me, rather, it was a little depressing. But these are two women who both really have in mind protecting victims, and they just differ on to the tactics.
You can join our conversation by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org, roundtable@wamc.org. We'll take a short break for news, and then we'll be joined by Jimmy Vielkind, Chief of Capital New York's Albany Bureau. You're listening to The Roundtable. Good morning. Welcome back to The Roundtable on this Friday morning. 9:36 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. Joe will be here very soon. And always nice to have Rosemary Armeo here. And Jimmy Vielkind joins us. Alan Shartok is here. And Alan, we have a new email in the hopper, yeah?
Yes, we do. Says Papagano, the comparison of Putin to Hitler by Hillary was limited to his excuse to protect German interests. He invaded those other countries to that extent. H-I-M-H-O.
In my humble opinion, yes.
Yes,
you know,
I get it now.
Alan, you must know this. I listened to your discussion yesterday with the Holocaust survivor. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
But it's so difficult to make any comparison or metaphor involving Hitler or the Holocaust. You just immediately get embroiled in a tangent. And I mean, I think the comparisons are apt here. Historically, we're going down a similar route. And yet you bring it up and it's like suddenly, oh, you're saying he's killing, you know, Jews and putting them in concentration camps. No, it's a historical thing.
And you know, his name shouldn't be off the table just because of that. And there's the old adage, I have no idea if it's true, that if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it.
Right.
And so Hillary made points, and they were strategic points with regard to the run-up to World War II. Anyway,
with regard to the run-up to her potential election as president of the United States, I may also say.
Well, there you go again, bringing politics into it.
But we have a difference. We do have a difference of opinion on this. Until he really shows that he is a Hitler-like person going into other countries and into this country, I think, because Rosemary did such a wonderful job of laying it out in the beginning about what makes this different from other things and where the legitimate Russian interests are. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a stretch. I do.
Okay. And once again, the email address here is roundtable@wamc.org if you want to weigh in. And we are joined at this time by Jimmy Vielkind, Chief of Capital New York's Albany Bureau. Nice to have you here, Jimmy.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, another exciting week in Albany. Boylan convicted on 21 counts. Let's start with that one.
Dog bites man, legislator convicted of federal bribery charges. And yes, the victim today is, or the victim this week is Assemblyman William Boylan Jr., a Democrat from Brooklyn. The son, he's a second generation legislator. His father won the seat, resigned, and then Jr. won in a special election with, I think, you know, fewer than like 2,000 votes or something kind of like that. And he didn't really have a distinguished record of service in Albany. He had the worst attendance record. There was one year where he sponsored no bills whatsoever. And this was his second federal corruption trial, which is rare. You know, I kind of was thinking of like the Academy Awards, like this is the second federal corruption trial for William Boylan.
No,
and he was actually acquitted.
You have to work at that.
In his first trial. Well, so he was acquitted in his first trial where the feds alleged that he was sort of trading legislative favors for money. I mean, he was acquitted, so that was not proven. Let me be clear on that.
Okay.
But what he was convicted of was soliciting bribes to pay for his criminal defense in the first criminal trial. And then in the course of doing that, they discovered, because he was caught on an FBI wiretap in Brooklyn, I think in Atlantic City, while he was claiming that he was in Albany at the Capitol and thereby claiming his per diem reimbursements.
Wow.
And so he was also charged with defrauding, I think it was $70,000 of these reimbursements, where he was saying, oh, I was in Albany.
Doesn't he have a hideous attendance rate, in fact?
Yes. At one point, it was the worst.
Yeah.
I think he was down to about missing about a third of the votes. But the point is, we could go on and on and on and on about this guy. It's kind of amazing. But looking forward, based on his conviction, we now have 10 vacant seats in the New York State Assembly and 12 in the state legislature, 2 in the Senate, 10 in the Assembly, which means that about 1.9 million New Yorkers, about 10% of our population, is down a legislator.
Speaking of which, Jimmy, I was walking in the garage yesterday at the legislature, going over to teach my class, and there was a Cadillac. And unless I miss my guess on this, it was Malcolm Smith. Tell us a little bit about where he is right now.
His indictment is pending. He's one of two elected legislators who is currently under federal indictment. Now, of course, Mr. Senator Smith has pleaded not guilty, as has Senator John Sampson of Brooklyn. He's also pleaded not guilty. And so they're going about their business in Albany. They're voting on bills. Malcolm Smith was present for budget hearings.
Well, they have to be.
As a New York State taxpayer, I would just like to say that I want my part of the taxes that will go to this guy's pension. I'd like it to go to kindergartens instead, please.
He will receive a pension.
Glad
you brought that up. Yep, he will get a pension. So, you know, looking forward, you do make the good point, Alan. There are two more legislators currently under federal indictment. The feds are really big about, you know, not missing when they shoot with these kind of things. And so the question is, should there be special elections called? And as of now, Governor Cuomo, who has the power to call them, has indicated that he does not want to do so until he can see how many total vacancies there are. And then the second question is, well, okay, do we need to revive again our topic of ethics reform?
Right.
What needs to be done? Should we have a public campaign finance system? Should there be maybe some basic changes to the law? Or are these guys just really bad apples? And in the case of Boylan, you know, I think I can say this objectively, just really stupid about going about life and these things.
Okay, you've been around for a while, Jimmy, so and you're quite articulate about these issues. So the question I have is this. What you say really stupid, and yet it happens time and again and again, and I'm fascinated by the fact that they'll risk going to jail, but they really are adamant about not losing their pensions. And I just try to get inside their minds. I can't do it. I wonder if you have any insights.
Well, you know, it's the same thing. I think the last time or the two times ago that a legislator was convicted of corruption and lost their seat, I started to call around and talk to like some psychology people or some longtime public servants. And the basic point is that the same instinct that makes you say, me, vote for me, I'm the best, you know, to walk up to the front of the class or the front of the church or the front of the, you know, the Democratic Club and say, me, I'm the one. You know, the chutzpah it takes to put yourself out there like that.
Right.
And some people do that. Some people are more naturally shy, and that's a personality thing. But the whatever the mental traits are that give you that instinct are the same ones that kind of like, yeah, I'm entitled to that. Yeah, I'm invincible. Yeah, why not?
You know what I find interesting is that and it's another conviction in Albany, and it seems to me that there's absolutely zero outrage. Have we all become as the electorate and as journalists so jaded by this whole thing that here comes another one. Okay, go ahead.
I'm a little numb. Yeah, I feel a little numb to it.
It's like, oh, no, not again.
Well, yeah.
They all kind of blend in together.
And as I said, okay, there are two more currently under indictment.
Right.
You know, maybe two more convictions.
Yeah. Alan, how does it change? How do you make that change? They've been trying or saying they've been trying for years.
I think your second point is excellent, Ray. They've been saying they try. The governor sets up, you know, something called J-Cope, often thought of as J-Joke, which is going to clean things up. It doesn't work. So then he sets up a Moral Enact Commission. And we hear from some of Jimmy's colleagues, like Ken Lovett of the Daily News, that he's calling in plays saying who they should subpoena and who they shouldn't subpoena. But he has the issue. I was talking to a guy the other day who loves Governor Cuomo, and I said, why? He says, well, he's after all the crooks. He set up these commissions. Well, I mean, did he set them up to work, or did he set them up to have the issue?
Jimmy.
Well, I think a little bit of both. I mean, I think that Governor Cuomo recognizes that a government that is not perceived as corrupt is in his best interests, both for his work as a governor and his work as a coming candidate. You know, he is the person most associated with New York State government, right? So whenever you hear Albany politician in handcuffs, et cetera, even though Cuomo had nothing whatsoever to do with that, and I can't emphasize that enough, Andrew Cuomo has nothing to do with these alleged misdeeds. He is tarnished by it, and
yeah,
he knows that.
It's his government.
Right. And so he is pushing out of the general interest because he doesn't like, you know, he doesn't like these things happening. He doesn't want to. He's a taxpayer, too. He doesn't want to see these kinds of things going on. But at the same token, he knows that it is politically damaging to him and to everybody. So
there's something wrong, though. Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, go ahead.
We should say Alan's not in the office, so we're missing each other's cues here again, which happens.
We are. But speaking of which, his performance, perceived job approval rating, took a big hit this week, as we saw, Jimmy. 10 points, 52-42. What was that about?
Well, there are a couple of reasons that people are pointing to. It was 42% approval in the Wall Street Journal Marist poll. And then last week, Siena had the governor at 48-51. So kind of underwater in the job approval category for the third time in his administration and the third time in the last 6 months. I think you're seeing a few things. You're seeing the continued erosion of support among upstate and self-identified Republicans. Remember that they had been early supporters of the governor, and his numbers among those non-traditional Democratic constituencies were high. People liked what he was doing in those groups. And then he really lost a lot of support there after the SAFE Act, the gun control measure.
Yeah.
So we're still seeing that.
But isn't he also losing, Jimmy, isn't he also losing some because of the fight with de Blasio, who's a redistributive Democrat as opposed to his brand of sort of Clintonian Democrat.
Well, that's the argument that we're hearing from some progressives. Cuomo did drop among blacks and Latinos concentrated in New York City. And there are people who are saying that it's Cuomo's non-support for a tax to fund universal pre-kindergarten and a few other issues that's doing that.
All right, let's take a break here. That a perfect segue into the next segment, which is about the Cuomo Astorino de Blasio dynamic and how it plays out in the next round of elections. And we will do that right after we take a short break. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from the Brattleboro Retreat, helping people with mental health and addiction problems to make new starts. BrattleboroRetreat.org. The Black Sheep, downtown Amherst, a New York-style delicatessen and European-style all-butterscratch bakery, caterer, and cafe offering fair trade coffee. BlackSheepDeli.com. And the Linda presenting the Alex P. Sutter Band tonight at 8 p.m. TheLinda.org.
Well, it's the Roundtable. My, how this hour has flown by. 9:48 is the time. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue for a short time. And Rosemary Armeo is here. Jimmy Vielkind is here of Capital New York. Alan Shartok is here. So from Capital New York, a splendid website, by the way, Jimmy, the Rob Astorino Plausibility Tour. That's a good headline.
Thank you. So, Rob Astorino, the Westchester County executive, who is probably intimately familiar to some of our more southern-based listeners. Astorino officially declared his candidacy for governor this week, as was somewhat expected by most people closely watching this. And I actually spent a little time with him at the end of last week. He went up to Binghamton and to Tioga County and talked to Republicans, gave his shtick and gave his spiel. And we're seeing him emerge. So a few first thoughts. One is that he's got an uphill battle against Cuomo. Astorino has $1 million compared to Cuomo's $33 million in campaign cash. the polls in this early stage show Cuomo with a 40-point lead.
That's a big lead.
It's a big lead, but it's not unexpected, and it's very early in the race, and Estrino has not really presented himself on the statewide stage. So that's there. The other point is, what is he talking about? What is Estrino talking about? He is, in many ways, sort of what I call running sideways. You know, if you had asked George Pataki in 1994, and maybe Alan can weigh in because he was talking to George Pataki in 1994. I was not. Candidate for Governor Pataki, what do you think about transportation? Would say, oh, I think we should lower taxes and bring the death penalty back. Mm-hmm. And then if you had asked him, well, what do you think about this important issue in Buffalo? He'd say, well, I think it just emphasized how we need to bring back the death penalty and lower taxes. Right. And so it's a very clear message where Astorino is doing the same thing. He has points of attack on Andrew Cuomo, and that is going to be the basis of his campaign, as it should be for any good challenger. And the question is, my big impression with Astorino is he will be a credible critic. He, unlike some other, Carlo Paladino, who had the 2010 GOP nomination, his message was clouded. He was really good at whipping up sort of a populist furor, but he didn't quite have the background in government to be that credible critic that I think Astorino does. There are many challenges before him, including whether or not he'll be able to gain a clear path to the GOP nomination for governor.
Which is what Cuomo said.
Right.
Let's wait to see how he does in that primary.
Right. So
Cuomo doesn't want him. Cuomo would rather have Trump any day, that's for sure.
Well, I think that's exactly the point. And that goes to my point about how Astorino is the credible critic. Trump could be caricatured.
Yeah.
Arguably, Trump is a walking, talking caricature.
And I think it was from your website as well. You know, Astorino makes his line about the fairy tale. All Cuomo wants to talk about is Trump.
And the other thing that we're seeing from Cuomo allies, Democrats, various groups, is, you know, they're talking about abortion. They're trying to immediately, out of the gate, define Astorino as this extreme conservative who would be out of step with what what polls show are the social views of a majority of New Yorkers. So at the same time that Astorino is trying to make a fiscal case, he's trying to push on Cuomo for a few recent initiatives. The SAFE Act is one of them. That's the gun control bill. Most recent Cuomo initiative to offer a college tuition for prison inmates is another issue. You know, these are issues that he believes are bread and butter Republican issues. But at the same time, he's trying to make traction on them. Cuomo and Cuomo's allies are going to be throwing back at him abortion, gay marriage, et cetera, et cetera.
Hey, Alan, don't you think that to some extent the governor is using Bill de Blasio to burnish his credentials with upstate conservatives, and B, will end up using Astorino for burnishing his more liberal credentials? So in a way, this plays well for him. Do you not think so?
Well, he's 40 points ahead. When George Pataki ran against Mario, even in a terrible Republican year for Mario Cuomo, I said, how can a no one beat a someone? Boy, was I wrong. Mm. And remember that Astorino, as Jimmy has pointed out, or again and again, it comes from Westchester County, a Democratic place, and has a message that resounds, including the taxation thing. So these two guys are going to duke it out on taxation. Is Cuomo believable when he says he wants to lower taxes? And that's where you get into de Blasio, who I always call a redistributive Robin Hood guy, meaning take from the rich and give to the poor. And that is anything but what Andrew Cuomo wants. And you know, Jimmy, one of the things our listeners write to me about all the time is this question we hear this morning, that the legislature, the assembly, is not going to take up a change in the death tax. Do you think you could talk about that for a moment?
Sure. If I could, before I do that, though, you raise a really great point about the basic electoral math for any Republican candidate in New York is run up the score upstate, fight and win by a small or as big a margin you can is in the suburbs, being Long Island, Westchester County, Rockland County, the New York City suburbs, and then don't get creamed in the five boroughs. And Astorino knows this. So run up the score upstate. Okay, you've got the SAFE Act, push on that. You've got Cuomo criticism. That's you have a solid message going up there. Okay, run even or win in the suburbs. That's going to be a harder fight. You know, Astorino's going to have to talk about property taxes. Right. Cuomo can talk about what he's done for taxes and make a fiscal case. Don't get creamed in the city. That's hard for any Republican. That's where we see these wedge issues like abortion, same-sex marriage come into play. But as we just noted, Cuomo is seeing a little bit of softness on his left flank, and it's made clear by Bill de Blasio. Mm-hmm. Now, if I'm a liberal Democrat living in New York City, or if I'm a union member living in New York City, you know, I think it's clear that my values probably would not have me vote for Rob Astorino over Andrew Cuomo. But the question is, if I'm disenchanted with Andrew Cuomo, am I going to vote at all? And that is going to be part of what fuels Rob Astorino. Now, to that point, Alan, about the estate tax, you know, this is, I think, probably going to be one of the most interesting subplots of this year's state budget season. And, of course, our listeners know the state budget is due by March 31st. So we've had all this noise about how are we going to pay for pre-kindergarten? Is it going to be a tax? Yada, yada, yada. It seems like the answer to that is no. Cuomo has won. The Senate Republicans have held firm. I think that tax on New York City upper income earners is essentially dead. The question then becomes, what's going to happen to Cuomo's taxation plan, which is very multifaceted and includes, as you said, Alan, among other things, a rollback in our estate tax. It's not too surprising that the Assembly Democrats, and Democrats do dominate the Assembly, have not included that. What's more interesting is what's going to happen to Cuomo's signature plan, the property tax freeze. Now, this is sort of an interesting and arguably tough to execute program wherein voters and homeowners will see a check. They'll get a rebate check, incidentally, before the election day from the state if their municipality, their school district, their locality, their water district, yada, 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 adheres to that 2% property tax cap. This has been panned on both the left and the right. And I think that watching what happens to that program, if it gets rebooted, if it gets scrapped, whether or not Republicans, who are the dominant partners in the governing coalition of the state Senate, whether or not they embrace that program and carry it forward, that's going to be interesting to watch. So, you know, the tax battle, it's ripe for compromise, and it was almost crafted to be compromised and to be scaled back. Cuomo put things that the left would like, he put things that the right would like in his package. So that's very fascinating, and it's going to be playing out over these coming weeks.
Only about a minute here, Alan.
Well, if you own a family farm and your federal debt tax is above $5 million, and you go to New York City, New York State, and it's $1 million. You lose that farm, perhaps, because you haven't made that amount. You don't have that kind of money.
That's right, and you know, the people who are supportive of this, you know, they very articulately laid out their case, and it was people like the Farm Bureau saying that, you know, $1 million in assets is actually not so rare. You know, we hear the term millionaire, we think of millionaire, and you think, well, okay, that's how much I make in a year. But if you think about it in terms of your net assets, you know, you work 40 years, you know, I hope to be a millionaire by the time I'm about 65 and, you know, can start right out.
Don't have kids.
Alan, we have 30 minutes, 30 minutes, boys and girls, 30 seconds. Alan, you have another email.
Yes. Richard Dawson said, what happened
Richard
to the
Dawson?
Innocent spouse if the pay... Dick Dawson, it says. That's what it says.
Okay.
What happened to the innocent spouse if the pensions are taken away from convicted public officials? In other words, if you're married to a crook and their pension is taken away, what happens to you?
All right, 12 seconds, Jimmy. Let's do the Cliff Notes version.
Well, theoretically, you lose, and that's the big case. Of course, a pension is a contract. Contracts are protected by the Constitution. And people say, look, you know, you didn't save a lot for retirement because you knew you had this pension coming. It's not fair to take it away.
Rosemary?
I don't say that.
Oh, you're still...
No.
And I don't say it.
The guy's a crook, and he has victimized his family as well as us, the public.
All right, and we'll leave on that happy note. You know, what a fun time it was today. Alan Chartok, thanks for being here. Have a nice weekend. Rosemary Armeo, have a great weekend. Jimmy Vielkind, the website looks fantastic.
Thanks,
and,
Ray.
You know, maybe I'll pony up and get the Capital Pro subscription at some point, and I can read all the articles that you send me. But, you know, that's for another time. If you want to, email us. We would love to hear from you. It's roundtable@wamc.org. More Roundtable. In fact, two more glorious hours coming up.